I had no idea about how the sun has managed to reach the zenith and then to go down to its landing place, while I had the impression of only having been with this old man for just 1 minute. That was my first conscious supernatural experience. And when I tried to talk to my mother about why I was unavailable, of course she yelled and said, "Oh my God, my son has seen a contumbly. If you mention that to anybody, I will never take you again to the wood." Of course, she never did, even though I never mentioned that. I don't remember having done that at all. But again, the reason why I'm saying that is because these beings, a few years later, upon the death of my grandfather, finally appeared in the village as part of the ceremony that was going on around the funeral. Later on, it was not, I should say, more than 6 months after the burial of the body of my grandfather and the official ending of the funeral, I do remember this priest that showed up and eventually gave me a ride on one of those World War II BMW motorcycles. That was the first time I ever sat on a machine that moves that fast. But very little did I know at the time that this was a departure not only from a father and a mother, but also from a lot of other things, from my culture, per se. It felt to me, now that I think back to those days, that this departure and the death of my grandfather was a major transition time in my life, which shaped the kind of life that I'm living today. First, because with the death of my grandfather, one school of thought had been deleted in my life, and with the coming of the priest who took me away, another school of thought was being opened to me. In that religious institution, of course, the first 5 years were spent strictly in seclusion, in the course of which we were instilled French language in the most drastic way possible. It appears to me that the manner in which religious colonialism functioned at that time in Africa was heavily based on linguistic transformation, as if by changing the language we were using and by forcing the language of the colonizer upon us, it was possible at the same time to instill the very culture and the worldview embodied by that language, namely French in this case. And therefore, it was an extremely powerful experience because of its painful nature. Anybody my age who knows how to read and write still carries in his or her body the marks of his or her own education. We were whipped daily to assimilate different grammatical rules and different letters of the alphabet, mathematical equations, and so on and so forth. There were a constant campaign destined to develop individualism more so than community in us, and that meant that we were asked, therefore, to be on the lookout for anybody who, in speaking French language, made the mistake of inserting one traditional word in it. Consequently, of course, there was a constant suspicion developed around and also enforced by the fact that any person who were found making this kind of mistake was asked to wear the skull of either a goat, a sheep, or a cow, as they call it, were the symbol of one's own sin. For indeed, we were told that it was a sin to speak the language of our saviors, namely the colonizer, the French at that time, in this manner, and that it was extremely injurious, not just to the French, but to the God that they were bringing to us. After 5 years in this so-called missionary school, I was taken to the seminary, where another formal education started. The seminary was indeed a place of intensification of some of the doctrines that were instilled in us during the years at the missionary school. But the seminary was like a huge establishment, one of those establishments that are equivalent to a normal high school in the United States or any Western countries, but which were there to absorb children, boys especially, coming from every area of French West Africa. The purpose, to form people from the native land, those they call indigenous people, into strict missionaries who were therefore to replace the missionary that were sent from France to pursue the task of evangelization of the west part of the African continent. And so we were therefore part of a grand colonial scheme to perpetuate the whole business of religious colonization. And so we were told that the ways of our ancestors are sinful ways, that we were responsible in the reversal of those ways so that the light of God can visit our villages and our tribe. And over the years, a lot of us believed in that. For me, at least, I believed in it partly because I had read by then very intensively and understood that there were certain basic truths in the Bible that were not very well presented in the day-to-day actual life of the priests that were in charge of us in that seminary. On the other hand, very little of that took deep grip inside of my psyche because that psyche was constantly visited by the spirit of my grandfather, who would appear to me in key moment of my life to say one thing or another, to the point where I had the feeling that, in fact, he was not dead. He's still around. And therefore, every time in a moment of crisis, I would call on him, I knew that if he would not show up right away, it won't be long before he comes up telling me that he's coming to find out why I called on him. I mean, that was for me something which served like an ingredient that helped me survive the terrifying nature of modern education. The constant appearance of his spirit also kept me in touch with this essential part of myself, which he had communicated to me during his lifetime, and which had something deeply to do with what I was supposed to be doing later on. There were moments when I felt extremely violent, and when I knew that if something does not happen, I would become responsible for a drastic tragedy that would lead to my total eradication. But I knew also that during those times, his energy was around to try to tame the wildness of my own spirit. There were one thing that we learned, because there were about close to 500,000 boys like me in that institution. There was one thing we learned, and it was how to trick and to challenge authority in such a way that we could maintain part of our own sanity in the middle of this huge lie that we were caught in. And therefore, one of the key places where the challenge was operational was on the concept of sin. Each one of us was assigned a priest that we're supposed to confess to every Friday night. To not confess was a sin. To say that you did not commit a sin in the past 5 or 6 days was a sin. And therefore, sin was inescapable. One other thing was the fact that you always have to come up with 5 sins in order to be in the average place. And so one had to have a list of sin, at least 5 sins, that you can at least repeat back to the same priest every Friday night in order to prepare yourself for Sunday Mass. I do remember being told over and over, but didn't you confess these sins last Friday? You've confessed them last Friday, and yet you did them again. I found out quickly enough that others of my fellow seminarian were also experiencing the same phenomena. So we decided to get together in order to create a sin market, something of a type where we will pass sins around and check on each other's notes in order to create diversity of sins. Now, what happened in the course of that kind of experience with that, eventually each one of us would come up with a much larger list of sin that are confessable because, well, we weren't authorized to commit mortal sins, because in the seminary, the sins are divided into two. They're mortal sins and they're venial sins. Venial sins are the kind you can easily confess and get away with. Mortal sins are the ones that are really serious, and therefore, as the person who is being prepared to become a priest, you cannot commit mortal sin. Well, I eventually committed one by grabbing one of the priests and throwing him out of the window. And so I could not confess that. That's what led to my running away from the seminary. But in terms of inventorying venial sins, we came up with quite an extensive list that we will rotate over the course of Fridays to the point where it was possible not to confess a familiar sin to the priest anymore. Well, of course, this whole thing was done consciously because we had to comply with certain kinds of expectation that were coming to us from the professoral corps made of priests. And so as a result, of course, with this kind of intellect, smartness, and skill developing in the adolescent souls and consciousness, we were getting bolder and bolder and bolder. What I know is that my own life there was cut short because of this particular mortal sin that I committed. What happened was that one day we were doing a dictation in the classroom, and this priest who has been bothering me over the years was again on my back, and one thing led to another, and as a result, he felt it was his prerogative to kick me, and in the past, I would let go, but this time, I could not. For some reason, I just jumped up, and before I found out, we were beating one another as if we're just two ordinary boys. Indeed, years and years of abuse were converted into so much anger power that the massive French priest felt like a piece of leaf in my hand. And so when he crashed through the window, breaking the glass and falling on the ground outside, there was a great sense of relief in me, even though the rest of the students in the class were really in a state of disarray. And that's when I realized that that gesture was a terminal gesture on my part. And that led me to wanting to run away, which I did, because I knew that there was no way I could be redeemed. But then again, thinking about it later on, I realized that a week prior to that, Grandfather had appeared to me and told me that I must come home. I did not know what home he was talking about, because after 15 years leaving my village and my language, my native language, having disappeared, my home was a seminary, even though I didn't like it. That was all I knew. By then, I was very literate. I was very fluent in French. I was very fluent in everything taught in French. And therefore, coming home did not ring any bell in myself that is close to reminding me that the home in question was the home that I had left 15 years ago. It took me about 11 days to walk to the village. It's only 125 miles. But what was important was not so much the walking to the village. It was the arrival in the village, because it coincided with a sudden discovery that I did not belong to that village. And what made me aware of the fact that I did not belong to that village was the sudden discovery of my inability to speak the language of my parents, the language of my brothers and sisters, and the language of all these people that lived in that village. People think of colonialism as a kind of gentle help extended to primitive culture for their own good. Of course, the colonizer has a right to depict its own mission in this manner to its own people. But when your own native language has been taken away from you, a lot of things go away from you along with that language. When a new language has been instilled in you, a great deal of things, worldviews, cultural things, come along with that new language. So arriving home was a very sad thing for me. All I knew was that I was an odd thing. I could not even communicate to my parents about my feelings. I could not communicate to my sisters in such a way that they would understand what it means to have been away for 15 years. And I found my own anger coming back up again against my father, whom I thought had let me go, in the sense that he did not do anything to stop me from being taken away. And yet all of these feelings could not be expressed in the kind of language that would ensure understanding from the part of my father. I do not know what would have happened had I not started to benefit from the help of my mentor at that time. I referred to him by his name, which is Giso. And because he is the brother of my mother, he's, by village standard, my male mother. And usually it is part of the village dynamic that a male mother is called upon to resolve any kind of tension that a person like me would be experiencing. The good thing about it is that Giso also was a powerful medicine man. His years and years of experience, because he took the seat of my grandfather upon his death, led to his becoming aware of my return home long before it even happened, and he's seeing in me the final task that he was supposed to perform before he checked out of this life. And so Giso, as my mentor, was the person involved with taming my wildness which I acquired in the course of these 15 years at the hands of white Jesuits. The problem, however, did not get resolved overnight, because here I was in a family forced to live there because I did not have any options of returning back to the seminary, the kind of world that I was familiar with, and finding myself on a daily basis facing the same thing over and over again. And it was basically the fact that I had a tremendous problem integrating the family dynamic and the village dynamic. At the family level, my father was at odds with my temper. My mother was at odds with my unpredictable character. And yet, they both wanted to figure out some ways to help. At the village level, there were talks going on about me, which I weren't aware of, but which was extremely important for the kind of future that was being cooked up for me. In the village, we have something as the Council of the Elders. It is made by 5 different elders who are in charge of the spiritual and cultural integrity of the entire community. Apparently, that council has gathered several times around me as their topic. And the main question was whether a person like me could be allowed to stay in the village. The one powerful argument that they had on the issue was not the fact that I was the only one coming back from what they call the wilderness, because every place that is other than the village is called the wilderness. It was not because I was the only one coming back from the wilderness. It was because I was the only one who knew how to read and write. The village, and in this case the elders, had become aware that anybody who knows how to read and write is connected with deceit, violence, and all these negative things, because the white men knew how to read and write. And it seemed to them as if it is that knowledge that fostered the kind of violence they landed on the villagers over the past century. And so here was one of their own who had managed to learn how to read and write, just the same way as the white men knew. And so for them, they were afraid that that was a disease that could infect other people in the village. The other thing they were afraid of was that they wanted to tame my wildness through what they call initiation. But they did not know what was supposed to happen in a context in which the knowledge of reading and writing was assumed to have taken the space inside of me that initiation was meant to take. And therefore, they thought that I was full to the point where initiation wouldn't have a place to fit in within me, because knowledge of literacy had already occupied that area, that territory. The other thing was that for them, the requirement for me to go through initiation was to forget how to read or write. I still remember a session that I had with my father. It was more like a discussion where the question arose about whether it was possible for me to work hard at forgetting how to read and write so that I can clean up the space in my psyche that could then be occupied by initiation. When I told my father that I could not forget how to read and write, he told me that therefore I was caught up with a terminal knowledge, the kind of knowledge that comes more like a cancer that you can't take away. The problem I was facing at that time was lesser, because the day-to-day work that I was having with my mentor, Giso, had dramatically diminished the violent inclination that I was in when I first arrived in the village. And so it felt to me that at that point, I was more interested in initiation, even though I did not understand exactly what it was and what it was meant to do to me. My father explained to me that initiation was going to be the opportunity for me to fully belong to this village, because everybody who grows up in the village has to go through initiation as part of their becoming not only adult, but of their being accepted by the rest of the village as grown-up human beings. So for me, having been away for so long, having been opened up to a world drastically opposed to the one of my own ancestors, I saw in initiation something like a doorway capable of maybe putting a dent on the amount of transformation or brainwashing that I had experienced in the course of the past 15 years. Of course, I wanted to go through initiation no matter what. But of course, I had to face up to this whole thing about forgetting how to read and write. And the problem at that moment was no longer whether my father wanted me to go through initiation, whether Giso wanted me to go through initiation. It was whether the whole council was going to agree to putting me up into this kind of experience. I was told that there were a lot of division among the members of the council because some of them thought that this was totally inappropriate for a person of this kind of knowledge that I had to also be given another knowledge when everybody knew that this knowledge acquired at the hand of the white man has taken in me the space that the village knowledge was supposed to take. Others simply said, two knowledge cannot be together, especially when they are drastically opposed, as that which initiation affords and that which schools in the Western world affords. They say that a person who is caught in this kind of space is likely to die. They also made the point that it takes a person who was born and brought up in the village in order to have all the chances needed to survive initiation. And here I was, with only 5 years of my 20-some-odd years being lived in the village, and the rest outside. Wasn't it a murder to put such a person into this kind of experience? Had this happened before, no one could testify to that. And so there were more reasons against my initiation than there were for that initiation. I think today that whatever happened that opened the pathways into this experience was something that came primarily from the spirit of my grandfather, who knew all along that in order for me to live in two worlds and to do the kind of work that I'm called upon to do, that I had to go through this kind of experience. I also knew that my mentor Giso, who was also part of the council of the village, was doing his best in order to make this happen. Later on, he will be also sitting in the committee of initiators, and as a result, be my protector, my secret protector, throughout the entire experience. What I would like to get into at this point is what constitutes the core of Daggara life. It has to do with this acquisition of knowledge called initiation or bar, which is the village word for the same thing, and which is based on the perception of the person who comes into the village as a person who carries along with him or her a big baggage that is supposed to be delivered to the village for its own good and for the good of the person who carries that baggage. There is a certain perception that village people have of themselves that associate life with a mission, that associate life with a certain kind of responsibility to be fulfilled in the interests of a better community. The village perception is that in order for a person to wake up into that responsibility, that person must be put into a magical space where he or she can then remember personally what the details of these baggages are, so that upon returning to the village, he or she is now capable to begin unloading. Up until that time, the person is considered a child, is considered a dependent of the village, who must therefore be prepared to enter this initiatory path in order to be freed from this dependency. There is also this perception which is linked to the previous one, and it has to do with mission. In order for one to fulfill one's mission, one must have the blessings of the elders. In order for the elders to give their blessing, one must be willing to embrace the kind of spirit which makes elders want to bless the person who embraces the spirit. Because the culture of the village is intimately linked to other world, the world of nature, the belief is that the most intelligent being in the universe is a plant being, that the second most intelligent being in the universe is the animal being, and that the least intelligent being in the universe is the human being. And therefore, the human being must go to the school of the animal and the plant in order to learn how to remember, in order to be able to complete his or her mission in this life journey. Elders say that they're constantly at that school, and they would listen to anybody who begins by surrendering to that kind of school. And the more they learn at that school, the more they discover the existence of other world where they can get as much help as they want, where they can feel a greater expansion of their soul and their heart, and where they can acquire what is usually seen as magical, when in fact, the more you dwell in this kind of world, the less you see it as magical, because it is the familiar. It is the kind of thing that every human being is entitled to, and is the kind of thing that is at the core of human nature. The search, the intent search for the magical, which is seen in the village as the real school and the real discipline to learn. So basically, initiation become therefore one of the core rituals designed to open up this magnificent world to the growing adolescent, and to give a context where the adolescent can fit in, a context where the adolescent can see where he or she is situated in this universe including the reasons why he or she came into the village. They usually say that if the knowledge of such a purpose is given to you by someone else, that you are likely to live the life of that someone else. Then when this revelation comes to you separately and independently from any person you know of. And this is the reason why, even though the elders know that through this ritual inquiry, you are here in the world to do one thing or another, they don't just go ahead and communicate that to you, saying that, listen, while you were in your mother's womb, we asked you about this and this, and this is what you said, and therefore you better do it or we're going to be very angry at you. They believe that the reason why the adolescent is tense is primarily because these very forces are itching and wanting to burst open. And they are not going to burst open through some kind of instructional moment or instructional lesson provided by some knowledgeable elder. They are only going to come out if the context is properly created and that itching adolescent is thrown in there to walk his own walk and to discover for his own self, for his own good, what matters to him and what does not. And so this is part of the general philosophy of approach to initiation. In the village, one must go through initiation as early as the age 11 to about 14 or 15. When the issue of initiation was brought to my attention, I was into my 21st birthday, and that raised another problem. The problem was how much of that knowledge can be revealed without harming the person when you have waited so long to jump into it. The thing that is always in the mind of the elders as they put a child through an initiation is how many habits have taken over the person to the point where he or she may be inflexible to certain demands that require that in order to acquire certain knowledge, you exercise flexibility. And indeed, for myself, of course, the question was enhanced simply because as a result of having undergone modern initiation, they called it initiation because of what it had done to me. So as a result of having undergone modern initiation, I was therefore less flexible in the material that were going to be presented to me by the elders in the course of the initiation experience than the other adolescents were. And this was, again, a problem for me. Initiation, as I experienced it in the village, was the most powerful thing that I've ever experienced in my life, and the kind of thing that changed everything systematically in my life. It is also the kind of learning which happens in the fast lane, to the point where what happened in the course of the time I spent in initiation was far more to me than what I learned later through 12 years of college studies and upon accumulating 4 BAs, 3 master's degrees, and 2 PhDs. When, for one reason or another, my initiation or my involvement with initiation was approved by the Council of the Elders, I found out about it one morning when there was a town crier who came to the house, and marked the house with a white cross while singing some kind of strange song, and ran away before I even got the chance to ask him any kind of questions. So I asked my sister what it was all about, and she said that this whole choreography means that a person in the household thus marked is going to be taken away from this place into the spirit world to experience the initiation itself. Of course, I understood that that meant that I was in. That afternoon, when my father came back from the farm or from wherever he was, of course, he took me into the medicine room. And I would like to say that every household has the medicine room where major things that need to happen must be brought to the attention of spirit prior to their happening. So my father took me there and made his prayer and his libation to the shrine of the family. And then the whole family came out and accompanied me outside of the village to a place where other adolescents from other households had been accompanied also by their families. And there we met. And the first thing that happened was that each one of us was supposed to take his clothes off and hand them over to the family before walking out of the village and into the bush where the council of initiation was supposed to be waiting for all of us. Of course, such a moment is always highly emotional. Some sisters were crying, some brothers were crying, simply because of the fact that everybody knew that going into initiation meant no guarantee of returning from initiation. And so the goodbyes were genuine. People cried in the arms of one another before separating. But it didn't take long before all the initiates found themselves alone in the field. Prior to that, of course, I didn't experience any kind of emotion because I was not that linked to the very family that had accompanied me to that place. At the initiation place, I thought of encountering something like a very nice camping ground where each child has a sleeping place, comfortable, and where, of course, instructions are given as to when meal times are and when free times are authorized and when work is expected and so forth. None of that. Upon arriving, we're all asked to go make our bedding. Well, I did not remember having brought any kind of camping bag or something of that sort. And so I realized that what the other were doing was just cutting leaves from different trees that they were putting one next to the other in order to form a cozy place where they can lay down on. So without further inquiry, I proceeded to do the same thing. One thing I need to mention here is that the son of my mentor, whose name was Nyangoli, was the person whom I was using as a frame of reference, the kind of person whose action I would just follow when I do not understand anything of what is going on. So that afternoon we spent preparing our sleeping place. And then the evening came when we were introduced to the Council of Initiation, made of elders of all types, but each one of whom was basically responsible for some key part of the initiatory experience. The first thing they told us was that, you know, you were abandoned by your whole village. The road back to the village is through this kind of death pathway, that any person that doesn't want to die will die. and any person that want to die will live. Of course, there were a hint of metaphors and symbolics in this whole language. We were at around a fireplace, burning bonfire that was more like the focal point. We were also buried inside a huge and growing rhythmical space. Each one of the elders, when they moved in, was quite painted up in some kind of phosphorescent paint that was extremely impressive in the dark. That night, of course, as the fire ceremony progressed, I began to realize the proximity of the kind of world that we were supposed to experience. But I did not understand, of course, at that time, at that early stage, what I was supposed to really be ready for. The next day, the first experience we were asked to get involved with was a gazing experience. Every one of us was asked to pick a tree and to sit about 20 feet away from that tree and to start looking at the tree. The moment I heard that, my mind went into a serious questioning job. I wondered what kind of good would there be in sitting 20 feet away from a tree and looking at a tree. At first, I noticed indeed that during that time of the year, the temperature of the sun in that area would go well into the 100s. We were all naked, and we're supposed to sit on the gravel that were heated up by the sun. And the experience, which was supposed to start around 9 o'clock, was supposed to last as long as the whole thing was yet to be completed. And I should say here that there were about 64 of us, ranging from age 11 to about 15. I was close to 21 at that time. And so I was much, much older than anyone there, because those of my age had gone through their initiation approximately 7 years earlier. So I just did what everybody else was doing, picked up my tree, moved to a sizable distance and sat there in the heating gravel and started to look. My mind went into deep thoughts. At first, I wanted to find out what it is that could be behind the whole idea of sitting in front of a tree and looking at a tree. I couldn't come up with anything. So very soon, I found out that I had something to work on. It was the great heat of the day. The sun that was reaching the zenith at that time was beginning to be very unbearable. My sweating body was preventing me from having any kind of focus at all on any tree, let alone that particular tree that I was supposed to have chosen to look at. And so I decided to take care of myself. The sweat was supposed to be cleaned up because first I couldn't see. It was popping out of my face and running down my cheeks and my eyes, and therefore I needed to take care of that. In the meantime, ants, who for one reason or another had taken notice at me, at my sweating body, had decided to climb my body and to drill in for some kind of food they had noticed. Of course, that kept me busy almost the entire day, at least until around 4 in the afternoon, when I realized that some of the kids were coming back, as if they had completed their tree-gathering business, and therefore were ready for the evening activities. So that time, I became more attentive. I started to look more, to pretend, at least, that I was very attentive to the kind of exercise that I was assigned to do. So I focused my attention on the tree. But at the same time, I noticed that indeed, my mind was far removed from it. I just wanted to pretend that I was doing the right thing at the right time for the right reason. And for that reason, it was just a look that I wanted to give, some kind of positive impression that I wanted to provide. The sun set and nothing happened. I was told to discontinue my exercise simply because at night it was no longer useful to do that. In the meantime, almost everybody had completed their exercise and come back to prepare themselves for the nightly activities. Something in myself started at the time to take things seriously. Not because I understood what was supposed to happen in the exercise itself, but because I had begun to realize that maybe there were indeed some kind of strategy that could have opened up a door to the completion of this experience so that I could look normal like everybody else who at that moment seemed to have completed their exercises. That night, it was hard for me to sleep, mostly because of the kind of fire ceremony that we had had, but also because of the fact that I had found out that the next day, anybody who had completed their exercise would be assigned something else. And I found out that I was probably the only one left who was going to be trailing behind on a tree-gazing experience, while other people who had completed that same experience would be assigned something else. The feeling of this was not comfortable at all. And so, as soon as day broke and people were sent to their other activities, I went back to position myself at the same place facing the tree. I did really look intently. I don't know how many hours, but my body and my mind were in it at first, probably because the morning weather, the morning sun, was not trying to take a toll out of my body, but also because I was hoping to at least get the whole job completed quickly so that I can catch up with the others who were out doing something which I believe was a lot better than this boring activity of sitting down watching a tree. I was beginning to feel a mixture of feelings ranging from the hate that I have for the exercise to wanting to complete that exercise to wanting to trick somehow the whole thing so that I can make believe that it is over. I didn't know which one was more important than the other, but I kind of made myself available to grab whichever one would seem handier at any time so that I can bring this whole thing to a close. The sun rose, the heat along with it. The ant again took notice of me. The sweat began to pop out of myself. And that's when everything became intense. At the same time, and like the previous day when one elder was assigned to me, I noticed that there were almost four elders now who were sitting comfortably 10 feet away and carefully watching me. That sudden realization of being on the spotlight of these old people increased my self-consciousness and forced me to pursue the exercise from a different angle. A stubborn one that wanted to get it over with. But the constant increase of the heat began also to take a toll on my ability to concentrate. This became worse as a result of again these ants finding their way to my body, and most of them, upon touching it, drilling directly into my skin in search of God knows what. And so more often than not, I found myself nervously hitting different parts of my body where I suspected such an intrusion than paying attention to what I was supposed to pay attention to. I realized that at that rate, I was not going to go anywhere. Because by the time we were in the middle of the afternoon, I was still on square one, as if I had barely started the experience itself. Something that felt like guilt crept into my heart, and I realized how hopeless my situation was at the time. And so my mind took over and entered creativity in an attempt at least to give the impression that I was deeply serious and I was deliberately trying to do something that would produce a breakthrough. I figured that in all likelihood, these elders expected me to see something in the trees or about the trees that was not necessarily visible under ordinary circumstances. It was a good guess, although it was wrong, but I decided to try it anyway. As if the supervising elder had noticed that, he curiously asked the question if I had seen something, or if I was seeing something. So instinctively, I just said, yeah. Right now, instead of the tree, I see an antelope standing up on its hind legs. The elder's eyes narrowed, and he said, what? And I repeated the same thing again, feeling like maybe I had hit bingo. But instead, he told me, well, keep looking. And the elders also just stood up, looking at me as if they had heard something dramatic about me, that something terrible had happened. It was at that moment that I realized that indeed, not only were they expecting me to see something, but that something better be the kind of thing they know about, that they expect me to see. I also felt some kind of shame beginning to come out as a result of this failure that I had experienced. At least all I remembered at that time was a deep sense of failure or discomfort, something of a chaotic nature, which momentarily at least deleted the feeling of heat coming from the sun and also made me forget, momentarily at least, the presence of all these ants that kept biting on my skin. I remembered one thing that happened prior to my being taken to the initiation place. The image of my father taking me to the shrine, along with the kind of thing that was said at that shrine, all of that came together. By that time, we're moving closer to the evening than we were to the middle of the afternoon. I decided that somehow something will have to happen or I would die sitting here. I made the decision that I'm not going to leave this place until something happened. Whether it is evening or night or day didn't matter for me anymore. I noticed that the more I was doing that, the more attentive the group of elders were to every activity, whether mental or physical. I cannot tell what other thing happened that produced the breakthrough, but it didn't take long before I had at first a feeling as if I was blacking out, as if I was losing consciousness, as if something really wrong was beginning to happen. But I noticed that in that split moment, the tree that I was looking at stopped being a tree. As if something had replaced the tree. A human being. Tall, feminine, green lady, as I'd call her. At first, I felt as if, yes, somehow I'd lost consciousness because of the combination of intense heat and all these other emotional things that have been happening to me in the course of the day. No one can survive this kind of thing. My mind was pretty clear at that time. But also I noticed that my emotional self was extremely intense at that moment. before I could actually interpret.